You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Maggie Dawn, you're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is the 3 o'clock hour, and that means it is Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. This week, we've been talking about global power and the intersection of political power and money and economic policy and tax policy. We've heard how our economic policies over the last 25 years have helped contribute to the rise of an oligarchy, basically, in the United States, but that is also global, with a very few number of people basically controlling all of the wealth on the planet. And we've learned about billionaires using their wealth to control the Supreme Court, and we've heard how geopolitics is also affected by money. Now we're going to talk about how those policies and politics and all of that money-generated power impact our democracy. We're going to talk about a thing called austerity, and I couldn't think of anybody better than Professor Clara Mattai, Professor of Economics and Director of the CHE, which is the Center for Heterodox Economics of the University of Tulsa, Oklahoma. She previously taught at the New School for Social Research and Economics and has been a fellow of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. Again, her research on the history of capitalism and this relationship between policy and economic systems and tax systems is right where we've all been spending our time in these segments, Maggie and the Millionaires. And her book title, her first book, really speaks to exactly this. It's called The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. Welcome very, very warmly, Professor Mattai. Clara, it's so nice to have you with us all. Thank you for taking the time. Let's start first. What is austerity? Why is this a thing? This is one of those terms, as an economist myself, I hate it when we use words like this because no one knows what they mean. But there's usually in economics like a common sense ability to understand these words. So let's start with austerity. What is that?
Thanks so much, Maggie, for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure. So yeah, austerity is the typical word that is rarely talked about because it kind of streamlines all the economic policies that don't work for people, but work for the system. So it's really interesting, actually, to point out how when we do talk about austerity, we have the wrong definition in mind, because they tell us that it's all about tax increases and public spending cuts. Now, this definition looks at the whole, the aggregate. So it tells us very little about where the state is actually spending and who the state is actually taxing. So really important here is to consider the class dimension. That is something that economists rarely use to figure out that austerity is A, about these fiscal policies that are, one, about cuts in social expenditures. So we see that we have a structural lack of funding for public hospitals, for public schools, for subsidies. I remind people that after the COVID relief plan for children poverty in 2001 were cut, we have child poverty rates in the United States has peaked to over 13%. So that's way over 1 out of 10 children in the United States in child poverty. So while you cut services for the vulnerable, you are ultimately subsidizing large corporations through incentives, through tax breaks, and of course, free-for-all military-industrial complex that is gaining, of course, for all of the massacres around the world today. Just in August, the American states spent $13.5 billion that is sending to the Israel's army right now. So this is fiscal austerity in the sense of the state spending for the few and transferring money away from the many working class people. This is works also for taxation. So where does the state take money from? And it's not just about increasing taxes. It's about the fact that the regular people pay more taxes than those who make a living off of capital income. And this more than me, the best people to ask are, of course, the patriotic millionaires who have been fighting for an idea that actually the state should use taxation to redistribute resources for the many rather than actually use it as a way to protect capital. So this is fiscal austerity. Fiscal austerity never operates alone. It usually goes together with other two elements that are very important for economic policy, which is monetary policy and what I call industrial policy. Monetary policy seems like a big word again, but actually it's very simple. The fact that the Fed has been increasing interest rates for over 2 years, this means once more that who is actually bearing the brunt of the stabilization of the economy is working people who not only have higher bills to pay at the end of the month on their credit cards, have higher mortgages, but also the whole point is that unemployment rates we know are going up, which means that people are actively losing their jobs. In the meantime, of course, capital holders have a blast because they get to make more money out of the money they lend. And finally, industrial austerity. So labor deregulation, meaning making labor more precarious, more flexible, and ultimately privatization, which is a big way of boosting people's market dependence. So this is more or less the definition. I conclude by saying that the whole point here is to understand that this austerity trinity, as I have kind of studied it, is not just the product of neoliberalism and the last 25 years. It actually has a longer history. And it's not just bad policy. This is really kind of, I think, the core message for the audience I have today, for the listeners, is that actually we need to realize that austerity serves a very vital function for the preservation of our economy in the sense that it forces people to sell their capacity to work for a lower wage because there's no other alternative. So if you have to pay for your healthcare bills, if you have to send your child to a better school because the public school system doesn't work, if you have to pay high rent, this means that you are more willing to be disciplined by the labor market and accept lower wages. So this is the core of how economic growth functions under capitalism, is actually the possibility of exploiting workers to a higher degree. And I think if we want to speak about progressive politics, then we need to understand why austerity is so much in the DNA of our economic system and what we can do politically to kind of change the priorities of our economy.
All of this so fascinating, right? Because I have training and consider myself an economist, these things that you just ticked off, these three pillars of austerity economics, are talking points that have bounced around for a very long time within sort of the accepted economic viewpoint of politicians and think tanks within the United States. Frankly, adopted by many, what I'm going to call Democrats or liberal progressives, in a way that does not serve what is a liberal progressive aim, which is an expanding and wealthier middle class, right? That wealth, if we're experiencing economic growth, should primarily reward the middle class that provide the labor and the work that is the engine of the economy. Again, those three pillars: fiscal austerity, which basically includes cuts in everything that the middle class depends on, right? We'll spend less, but we won't spend less in military spending or these other things. We'll spend less in the programs and policies that serve the middle class. Plus, increased taxation, largely a shifting of taxation burden to the middle class, away from corporations and the wealthiest people. Secondly, monetary policy, where the Fed raises interest rates. Again, that cost ends up being borne by the middle class, as those that hold capital and can lend it and therefore benefit from that higher interest rate are made more wealthy. And then finally, industrial policy, which led by conservatives on the Republican Party since the time of Nixon in this country, has effectively deregulated labor markets, has attacked unions and organized labor, the very institutions that help workers bargain for greater benefits, greater job security, and of course, higher wages, all of this combining to a destabilizing effect on capitalism. That's where I want to start. Why, or ask next, why do all of these things add up to effectively favoring fascist adjacent or fascist like governments? Why is this contrary, this conglomeration of factors? Why does that erode democracies?
Thanks. There's so much to say here, and you did a wonderful job at putting everything together. So before answering your question, if I may, I wanted to just specify the fact that when we talk about middle class, it's important because it's what we're really talking about the majority of the time is actually the working class who has gained, you know, some form of economic security, right? In the sense that when we talk about class, it's very important to not just focus on the amount of money we have in our bank account, but that is obviously less and less for the majority of people, but where we stand in terms of how do we make our living? Do we make our living by selling our capacity to work for a wage and kind of in this way don't really have a say too much on like what we do at work and what this work is like being used for, and or do we actually control the means of production? Do we invest capital? Do we make our money out of capital income? And this is very important because we realize that actually the majority of us is working class, and this even if you know we make a good amount of money, the point is that we all are all in the same boat in wanting to safeguard some form of protection against what is a generally a tendency of our capitalist economy that is again increased by public policies of increasing our market dependence. And once more, the market dependence is what provides our compulsion to accept our subordinated condition in the labor market. So this is very important, I think, because what we would like is to see a broader middle class, but ultimately middle class does not really fit with the fundamental divide that is the grounding infrastructure of our economy, right? So this is important. Now,
I'm going to hop in here. I just want to reintroduce you. We're talking to Claire Mattei, professor of economics and director of the Center for Heterodox Economics of the University of Tulsa at Oklahoma. We've got about 2 minutes left. I want to get back to this idea, Clara, that well, gee, if we've created these three pillars of austerity economics that basically makes anybody who goes to work very subordinate, we don't get to choose whether we work or how we work or what our work is used to produce. We are forced into these labor markets in this way with very little say over compensation, benefits, or the how of how we work. What does that mean if it's destabilizing a democracy? What does it mean if we don't have those choices, and yet the oligarchy of the United States and globally still need us to work? We're going to come back with Dr. Mattei after these very brief messages. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Something happening here.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. As it is that we are in the 3 o'clock half hour, it is Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. Today's special guest is Claire Mattei, professor of economics and director of the Center for Heterodox Economics of the University of Tulsa, Oklahoma. She wrote a book called The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. Welcome back, Professor Mattei. Thank you again for making time. We've been talking about how this economic policy of austerity that makes it very hard for individual workers, and we're all working class. If you get a paycheck, you're working class. That's what we're talking about. You got to work for a living. Makes it very hard for us in the way that our economy has evolved to have any semblance of true choice, right, in the way that we work. And that this concentration of wealth and political power in the hands of very, very few, and again, the alienation of the worker, for lack of a better term, is destabilizing to capitalism. You had some few thoughts on that because I want to understand more why.
Thanks so much. I think it's really interesting if we adopt, and that's what I've been trying to do in my own work, challenge a little bit the lens that is usually used by, you know, mainstream economics. That is the lens that kind of thinks that economists have kind of an objective, hard truth-like lens through which to look at the world. And this ultimately then flattens out the picture ultimately a understanding of reality that hides what is really happening rather than explain it. And so a lot of the role of actually economics as a science has been to ultimately justify this tendency of concentration of economic and political power in the hands of very few. Now, the question about democracy for this reason is a very tricky one, because we are meant to learn since we're little that our economic system is the one that best fits democracy as a concept. Now, if we try to be a little more critical, we realize that democracy hurts our capitalist economy. And this is something that actually then forces us to realize that forms of authoritarian government are not the problem for our economy, they're a problem for people. And I think this is really where the tension is that ultimately this tendency of our economy to concentrate and centralize through this real competition of capitalists that really try to beat each other in order to survive. And again, there's nothing moral about this. It's not about excessive greed. It's too easy to just say, oh, it's because the capitalists are greedy and it's all their fault. No, it's not about greed. It's the impersonal kind of, it's the impersonal structure that kind of shapes people's behavior. And of course, the structure is made by people. So again, we made this type of economy and that's why we can change it. But it's also true that once we made this economy, we are trapped in it. We're trapped in it as workers, in which in fact we lose our agency and have to kind of subordinate our role to others. But it's also the capitalists that have very little choice but to increase the rate of exploitation if they don't want it to succumb and to basically go out of business. So in this situation, the point is that democracy is not really in the picture. When people do want to oppose austerity policies, and again, we said that austerity is the way in which the state actively protects the market by protecting the capital holders and increasing the market dependence of the majority by taking away resources from working class people, then in this case, we realize that austerity is not very democratic. And when people do want to oppose austerity, which is what I think we should try to do in terms of what we want to see next, we see that the establishment protects itself from this calls for greater economic democracy. How? In various ways. Like there's a way to, you know, to insulate macroeconomic decisions from people. Independent central banks that we take for granted are an institution that has been created purposefully to put monetary stability above all else, including above raising employment, right? So this insulation of economic policies is, I think, profoundly anti-democratic. And it is true that historically, I've studied fascism, so Benito Mussolini, the founding father of fascism, to show that Mussolini was adored by liberals in the 1920s because of his capacity to effectively implement austerity by basically silencing workers directly and through, you know, abolishing unions and abolishing possibilities to strike, but also ultimately how then we see that under Mussolini, the economy was working in the sense that profit rates were going up, international investors were coming in. So I think the problem here is not that the economy in a way wants democracy, is that the economy does not really want democracy. And we need to try to find a way to force democracy into our economy.
So what should voters look like when they're assessing candidates in this next election cycle? We talk a lot about tax policy, and frankly, we got to tax the rich and the wealthiest corporations more. Again, it's trying to inhibit some of that exploitation tendency of this economy. What are a couple of specific things that voters should look for? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, really important. I think voters should really assert their economic agency by saying no more of this usual rhetoric that is true both for the Democratic and the Republican Party. Let's try to push our representatives to actually work for people and not for profit. Let's put the logic of need before the logic that is actually the logic of our economy, which is the logic of profit. So this won't happen on its own. The tendency of the system is anti-democratic, and the tendency is to concentrate more and more wealth in the hands of very, very few. But given that 62% of American workers live paycheck to paycheck, we need to say without us as people, the economy does not work. There is no value creation without workers going to work every day. And if this is the case, if we are so central, then we need to push politically. This won't happen on its own. We need to push politically and to hold accountable our representatives to actually speak in our interest, not in the interest of the few who profit from capitalism.
That's Professor Claire Mattei, Professor of Economics and Director of the Center for Heterodox Economics. Her book is The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. Thank you so very much, Professor. This is such an important topic. We could spend hours on this. Folks, I'm Maggie Dawn. This is The Maggie Dawn Show. You're listening to on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Into your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop now. What's that sound?
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.